The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are things we take for granted in our contemporary lives. Clean water, flushing toilets, streetlights, cars, fresh food, knowing the time. Things so basic to how we function that we don't even consider their origins. Well, Stephen Johnson does. His perspective on history is not about the wars and the great men, but the hobbyists, the obsessive tinkerers, the garage mechanics, and sometimes college dropouts. People whose ideas set off a series of events, innovations, and outcomes that brought us to how we live today. Stephen's author of several best-selling books on innovation. We spoke to him when his book, How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World, was first published. The book comes out in paperback next week. When we spoke, I asked Stephen why he chose to focus on those six innovations in particular. Time, glass, cold, sound, clean, and light.
I'm glad you named them all because I often blank on one or two of them when I'm actually asked to name them myself, so that's good.
It's like the Seven Dwarfs.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I forgot Sleepy. One of the things that I wanted to do or we wanted to do with the show is to not focus on innovations that seem very high-tech, right? We talk about innovation all the time in our society, but it's always about the latest gadget and, you know, the latest smartphone app and things like that. And so what I was interested in is things that have become so integrated into our lives that we no longer think of them as innovations in themselves, like glass, for instance.
Well, let's start with one of those most profound notions and the most far-reaching, time, which our concept of which has changed dramatically over the past 150 years when agrarian concepts of time were replaced by clocks, or more importantly, the pocket watch. These are the efforts of a man who was called the Lunatic of Boston in his time. Who was he? What was his story?
A surprising number of people in the book were called the Lunatic of Boston.
Yeah, Boston like figures
Boston
primarily.
It simultaneously generates interesting thinkers, but they are ridiculed by their peers. So it's this guy, Denison, who came up with this idea for basically kind of mass producing a watch. So up until around 1850, 1860, pocket watches were in circulation, but they were extremely expensive. And this guy, Denison, came up with this system basically modeled after the, kind of industrial production lines that were starting to appear for manufacturing things like guns. And he built this watch. It was called the Ellery watch. And it was really the first kind of breakthrough watch. It cost about a tenth of what other pocket watches cost at the time. And, it was kind of the kind of first draft of what then would become the, you know, the kind of Sony Walkman and the iPod more than 100 years later.
And it was also called the Soldier's Watch because so many soldiers had them during the Civil War. One of the results is that punctuality over a couple of decades becomes a social virtue, which was problematic at a time when hundreds of towns across the country had their own time, as did the 50 railroads operating in the U.S. That's what we learn from your book. How was this fixed?
Yeah, I love this is one of my favorite things because this is a classic example of this. Is we never think of coordinating time as an innovation, right? But as you said, until in the United States, until around 1880, every single town was basically on its own time zone. So you would do a local reading of the sun. The point at which the sun was the highest in the sky was noon. And that meant that, you know, as you went from town to town, it would be 2 minutes ahead or 5 minutes behind the last town. And the key thing about this is that nobody even noticed that this was a problem. It genuinely wasn't a problem. for an extremely long period of time because nobody needed to coordinate schedules between towns with that level of accuracy. It didn't matter if you lost a minute or two going from town to town because it took you an hour and a half on your horse to get from one town to the other. And then a new technology came along that exposed this problem or made it a problem in the first place, which was the railroad. The railroad suddenly meant that people were traveling from town to town in very kind of meticulously choreographed time schedules. And suddenly it was just incredibly hard to figure out what time it was. And so someone needed to solve this. And they'd kind of come up with the idea of standardizing time in Canada and in the UK. But in the US, it took quite a while. It was this guy named William Allen, who was a kind of railway clerk, basically, who got obsessed with this idea of building a time zone system. It was amazingly controversial. So all these during the period, this period, there were all these kind of angry letters to the editor written by people in towns across the country that are saying, Cincinnati will never adopt this artificial devil's time. You know, time is meant to be set by the sun as God intended it. But eventually people came around and actually the original time zone system that lasted for about 30 or 40 years, the edges of each division that now basically run along the edges of the states. Originally, in Allen's map, it was defined by the railroad termination points, not by the states, which shows you how important the rail system was to our sense of time in the late 19th century.
William Allen triggers this kind of chain of events, right? And this happens often in this book, in this series. One person trying to solve a problem, getting something stuck in their craw. One such man I think of, Edward Leon Scott de Martinville. He's a
nice pronunciation.
Well, you know, I did my best. A French bookseller, essential in recording sound. Now, tell us more about him and his innovation.
So he invented a brilliant machine. It was called the phonautograph for recording audio, for capturing sound waves out of the air in the early 1850s, which is more than 20 years before Edison invents the phonograph. But the reason we've never heard of him is that he failed to include one key feature, which was playback. There was no way to listen to the audio that had been recorded. You could just record these little sound waves, but there was no way to actually hear what you'd recorded. And it wasn't like he was trying to add this feature and couldn't figure out how to do it. It never even occurred to him. He was just, as I said, it was kind of in his blind spot. Basically, his technology didn't take off, and he more or less died penniless. But two things happened. First off, a number of years later, another inventor was tinkering with Scott's device, and that inventor was Alexander Graham Bell inventing the telephone. So the phonautograph failed on its own, but it contained the seeds of this other technology that would take off. And the other cool thing about this story is that a group of audio historians, they got together a couple years ago and they found Scott's recordings and they scanned them into a computer and got the computer to play them back. And initially they thought they were hearing a little girl singing, but then they realized they were playing it too fast and they slowed it down and realized it was Scott himself. Half a century later, he finally got playback added to his phonautograph.
Well, and there's just a wonderful moment in the PBS series when you play that audio. Let's just hear a little bit of it. We're talking with Stephen Johnson about some of the innovations that were so big that we don't even think about them. He is the host of the new PBS series, How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World, and a book of the same name. Understanding innovation and what you do is the long zoom, as you call it, over history. You encourage us to get rid of this concept of the eureka moment and instead look at the slow hunch. Thinking of one story, Frederick Tudor, who dreamed of getting rich by shipping ice to the Caribbean. Tell us a little bit about the evolution of his slow hunch into becoming the Ice King.
Yeah, he had this idea as a young man. This is, 1800 or so, and he went, he was from Boston, from a kind of well-to-do family in Boston. He went south to the Caribbean and then to I think South Carolina and Georgia and during the summer, and he was just kind of appalled at how hot it was. And he got this idea that if he could somehow take ice from these frozen lakes up in New England and store it and then ship it down to the South, to the hotter parts of the world, that presumably could charge him a lot of money for it. First off, he had to figure out a way to keep the ice from melting. And so he devised these various forms of kind of insulation that would do it. And it's amazing. It seems strange to us now, but if you have a large block of ice, it will survive without melting for quite a long time if you just basically pack it in sawdust and keep it out of the direct sun. So he figured that part out, but the part that really took him a long time to get was he managed to get the ice down to, I think he went to Martinique initially, and when it arrived, he figured out how to keep it without it melting, but his problem was that people just had no interest in his product. And say, basically, if you were living in the Caribbean in 1800 and you'd never left the Caribbean, you would have never seen ice. It just, it never got cold enough naturally for ice to form, and there was no way to mechanically make it. And so he basically had to kind of educate the customer that, you know, ice cream and taking a nice cool bath and putting an ice in your drink was a nice thing to do. And eventually he did persuade people of this, and he ultimately, you know, years and years and years later, after being mocked as another lunatic of Boston, he ended up being worth hundreds of millions of dollars in today's currency. And for a brief period of time, ice was the number two export in the United States after cotton.
You're listening to my encore conversation with the author Stephen Johnson, whose book How We Got to Now has been turned into a companion series from PBS. It's all about the surprising innovations and the chain reactions that have helped shape our world. Things like pocket watches and the ice cube and glass. We spoke when the book first came out, and I asked him about whether these inventions were really about the lone inventor. For example, if Frederick Tudor had not created the ice trade in the 1800s, or if Edward Leon Scott had not invented the phonoautograph, as he called it, would somebody else have likely come along and done it?
You know, it's a great question. I spent a lot of time trying to get this right. It's a tricky thing, particularly thinking about the format that I was working with, because I was developing this as a show on PBS and then as a book. And in a funny way, television kind of wants you to have a hero.
you want
to have the person you can see. But a lot of the message of this project is that, you know, that invention is much more of a collective, collaborative, network kind of affair, and that the single inventor is actually very unusual. In fact, there's a whole segment in both projects where we talk about Edison and how every school kid learns that Edison invented the light bulb. And in fact, Edison didn't invent the light bulb. Mm-hmm. There were 20 people who were working on the light bulb in various forms, almost all of whom hit upon most of the key ingredients that Edison hit upon. And Edison was aware of those people and building on their ideas. And as you kind of implied, there's an inevitability to that invention. Someone was going to invent the air conditioner by the, you know, kind of first years of the 20th century. It happened to be this guy, Willis Carrier, but there were other people working on it. And, you know, it was going to be invented by someone. It was just, in a sense, in the air.
With all of these positive changes, of course, you know, there is a less glowing side to some of them, especially for our Paleolithic era human bodies, you know. How have these innovations changed the way that we eat, live, sleep? What were the implications as far as you found in those areas?
Yeah, well, our bodies are not as evolving as quickly as the technology, mm-hmm. as our culture is, basically. And so occasionally you get this kind of lag. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that until artificial light came along in kind of the abundance of the late 19th century, where you had kind of gas lamps and then the electric light bulb in kind of the 1890s and at the turn of the century. Up until that point, in particularly in the winter, people basically would have what they call two sleeps. So they would go to bed as soon as it got dark, which, you know, in the Northeast could be, you know, 5 or 5:30 or something like that. And so they go to bed at 6 because there was nothing to do, basically. There wasn't enough light to kind of make it worthwhile to stay up. You had a couple of candles, and it was expensive to have those candles burning and so on. So people would go to sleep, but they didn't want to sleep for 14 hours. And so they would wake up in the middle of the night and be up for an hour or two and have a snack, you know, hang out, maybe light a candle and read a little bit, or, you know, procreate or, you know, use the facilities, whatever. Here, I'm trying to be gentle about this. And then they would go back to sleep and they would have a second sleep. And then all of a sudden artificial light came around, and suddenly after dark, your home, just your home alone or the outside world, was filled with all these things that you could do, you know. And you were like, well, I'm going to stay up and read initially, or I'm going to go out to a restaurant, or I'm going to go out and see a movie, or now I've got television and radio and I'm going to stay up and do that. And so we pushed back our bedtimes. And the argument is that when some of us suffer from insomnia, where we wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning, it's really that kind of the echo of this natural rhythm of sleep that we'd had for presumably thousands and thousands of years, mm-hmm. that has been artificially interrupted by this light cycle of the electric light bulb.
And in that conversation about light, you point out that the use of whale oil light made it possible for people like Jane Austen and Herman Melville and Emily Dickinson to stay up and write at night. I mean, just one of these things we would never think of. Do you have a sort of like craziest revelation of triggered actions during this series for you?
Well, I think actually the whale oil that powered, you know, kind of artificial light in that period of spermaceti oil from the skull of the sperm whale. And it was basically the cleanest and purest and kind of whitest light you could find. It was the state of the art in kind of lighting technology from about 1730, 1740 until around 1840 or so. And this is one of these places actually where there's a really interesting kind of disjunction, it would seem, from the state of the art in other technologies. So to extract this whale oil, they would first capture a sperm whale and kill the whale, which is incredibly hard to do. But then they would have the whale up on the deck and they would cut a hole in the whale's skull. And the youngest boy on ship, who could be like 12 or 13 years old, would then crawl into the skull of the whale and extract this whale oil with a bucket. And so this is in an age when, you know, people were inventing the railroad and the telegraph and all these advanced, you know, technologies, and the steam engine, you know, is rewriting the kind of history of the world at that point. But simultaneously with all of that, the most advanced form of artificial lighting involved a 13-year-old crawling around in a whale skull.
Who'd been dead probably for a little while.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems wrong that those two things would be happening at the same time. But sometimes you get advances in one field that kind of jump ahead and the other field kind of lags behind.
There are a lot of big questions that are circulating, of course, in our culture now about whether, you know, we're so scattered or stressed out by always being accessible, being always on, using our smartphones, for example. These innovations have changed the way we work, the way we live. And with your long Zoom of history, are we going to work these kind of questions out?
Well, I think, we're better at projecting forward, I think, and thinking about the unintended consequences. It's very hard to do that. I mean, I've spent a lot of time looking at innovation, but every time anybody asks me to, like, you know, wear my futurist hat and describe, you know, what life is going to be like in 20 or 30 years, I always kind of politely decline, because I'm like, if you look back at this book, you know, and one of the big lessons is that, you know, you invent one thing and it ends up triggering all these changes that you would have never anticipated in advance. And that's going to keep happening. But I think we're a little bit better. I think there's a lot more, for instance, writing about technology today that is thinking about the cultural impact of these new tools and not just, you know, kind of reviewing them as products. You know, I remember when I first started writing about technology, if you looked at people writing about computers, it was just, you know, it was just product reviews. You know, mm-hmm. It was like, oh, there's a new Mac and I give it 4 stars. And the idea that these machines were going to ripple out through society and change the way we listen to music and change the business models of all these creative industries and affect the way we communicate with our friends and the way that families form and national board, all these, you know, issues now that we kind of take it for granted that technology is going to shape our lives in this way. I don't think that was as much a part of the conversation 25 years ago, say. And so I think we don't have any easy answers to this, but we were at least, you know, asking the right questions now.
Stephen Johnson. His most recent book and companion PBS series is called How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. And the book is coming out in paperback next week. There are links to find more on the book and the series, including a video trailer. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for a conversation with a man who made an artificial tusk so realistic that it fooled smugglers and some very highly placed links in the illegal ivory chain. High-stakes taxidermy when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than 30,000 African elephants are poached each year, mostly in East Africa, also home to five of the world's least stable nations, according to the Fund for Peace. In an effort to understand the path illegal ivory travels, journalist Brian Christie commissioned a tusk of fake ivory that contained a GPS tracker in it. He then followed the path of the illegal ivory trade, which shockingly led to Joseph Kony, the infamous Lord's Resistance Army leader, who the State Department named a specially designated global terrorist. The path of that fake tusk became the cover story for National Geographic's September issue and a documentary called Warlords of Ivory. It is a fascinating and it's been a pretty well-covered story, but we're turning now to a man who was crucial in its making, the man who actually made the artificial tusk realistic enough to fool smugglers and players in the ivory trade. The man who created it is George Dante, founder of Wildlife Preservations and one of the world's premier taxidermists. His clients have included the American Museum of Natural History and the Bronx Zoo. And George, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you are one of the best taxidermists in the world. How did you get into the field?
I started doing taxidermy, like most people who got into it, at a very young age. I started doing it when I was 7 years old.
Wow.
Yes, I was always interested in art and science. I had a love for the outdoors. I was always a naturalist as a little kid, would spend numerous hours just collecting insects and chasing animals and just absolutely in love with everything that had to do with nature. And when I found taxidermy, it just seemed like the perfect marriage of art and science to me, and it truly is.
So you were the one that Brian Christie called to make this fake tusk. Tell me about that call.
Brian was actually talking to me one day, and he said, "Have you ever made fake ivory before?" And we actually have. We've had, you know, occurrences where we needed to make it for certain circumstances and nothing like this. And he didn't let on to really what was going on. He said, "Can you make it so it has the same sound, the same weight, the same density, the same feels?" And I said, "Well, as far as I know, that's never been done before." But unfortunately, he had the right guy, because I love a challenge. And it's probably against my better judgment sometimes, but it just intrigued me so much what he was trying to do. And he really didn't let on to what the project was. He really kept this under wraps, and even as we moved through the project, I wasn't keyed into everything that was going on. So it was really a very interesting project from the beginning to the end.
Well, I'm guessing that any leak about his intentions might have had the whole process collapsing.
Absolutely. It's an extremely sensitive project. We had to make sure any other employees in our studio knew what was happening. Everyone had to be in the strictest confidence in what was going on. And it was funny. We were having a conversation one day, and it really dawned on me about the magnitude of this project. When he looked at me, he said, "You do realize if you screw this up, you're going to get us all killed."
When did you find out the truth?
It was as we progressed into the project, not long after, little bits started coming out about what we were actually doing here. And then it really became very real on what we needed to accomplish. So I knew what he was shooting for, and I knew what was going to happen, but I didn't know everything. All I needed to focus on really was these need to be the best pieces that we've ever done, that anyone's ever done, because people's lives are actually at stake with this.
How did you recreate it to make it convincing in both appearance and in weight and density and, as you said, sound?
Well, it's very interesting. Unfortunately, we still cannot divulge too much of the information on how we did this. But I can say we worked for several months trying to come up with different resins and materials that we can use to mold and cast and pour into different molds that we made and basically construct a tusk that was made out of completely synthetic materials, but had the right weight. So we added different things in it to weight it. We had to add different things in it to create the correct balance points. We needed to add fillers to the material to make sure it had the right density when you felt it. You know, ivory is such a unique material. When you feel it, it doesn't feel like anything else. It's almost got a wood-like quality, but yet it's cold, so it almost feels like stone. It's very, very interesting material. And we just played around for several months, different materials, filling them with different things, constructing them in different ways, different methods, to try to get this as close as we possibly could. And through nothing more than research and development, trial and error, did we come up with what we did.
So how long did it take in the end?
It took probably 6 months to come up with a suitable material and suitable process of what we were looking for. And then we needed to figure out how we were going to finish them and work on installing the electronics. That was several more months of work trying to figure out how are we going to install these electronics to make sure that they're protected, to make sure that they still transmit properly. That was, again, something that's never been done before.
So that was a GPS, a thermometer? I'm trying to remember. What else was in there?
That is something I've been kept in the dark with as well. I know the person who made everything, but I know them just as a GPS transmitter. But there is a lot more going on in there. So I was handed the electronics and said, this is their tolerances. This is what we need to do. These are the antennas. These are the things we need to work around and basically go from there.
Well, your finished product was so convincing that Brian Christie and his crew were stopped at the Dar es Salaam airport when they came in. And even when they took x-rays showing that there were GPS in there and he was saying what he was doing, they still didn't believe him.
And that was a wonderful moment. And I'll never forget that. I was sitting at my desk and I received a phone call from Brian. And he said, George, he said, I'm going to pay you one of the highest compliments I possibly could. He said, you almost got me incarcerated in Africa. He said, I'm laughing about it now. He said, but I wasn't laughing about it then. It was a wonderful thing because then we knew we had succeeded. Mm. And basically, you know, these people know what they're looking at. They know what to look for. And he said they were completely stumped.
Well, while on assignment, Christie did travel to Garamba National Park in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And there he described that there was an attitude focused on preserving the park and its elephants in order to preserve something of value. Is this an attitude that you encounter often in the world of wildlife preservation?
We do. You know, I've modeled my business after really caring about the environment. We want to make sure that these animals are around for us to enjoy for many, many generations. You know, I look at this now, and my perspective on this is we need to do everything we can. We really need to take as much action as we absolutely need to and know the facts. There's a lot of things out there. And unfortunately today, it's easy to get the wrong information. When you read about elephant poaching, you hear everything you can possibly imagine. Brian was one of the first people, I think, to really uncover the truth here about what's going on. I mean, I don't think people realize exactly what he has done. He has really become this hero for conservation because of the work that he's done with just this project alone. And I think that's the wonderful thing. So for us, I mean, I look at this and I think about my daughter, and I wonder if she will ever get to see an elephant someday. And we look at this atrocity that's happening right now, and we really have to think this might not be a possibility.
Can you summarize for us, George, for those who haven't read the article and you might want to intrigue them into doing so, what did Brian Christie find?
Well, Brian found out that basically the end result in this, in illegal elephant ivory, is mainly China. China is one of the largest consumers of illegal ivory on the planet. And there is such an insatiable appetite for ivory right now that it drove the prices up on this material to, in some cases, over $4,000 a pound. What this has done is made ivory a currency. So what you're seeing is that now the ivory is not so much of a situation where you're getting the local poacher going in, killing an elephant and taking a set of tusks off of it. It's now very organized. It's military. It's come to the point where military are flying over the top of these herds of animals, killing them, dropping down with a helicopter, efficiently cutting off all the ivory, flying out of there. It's now a currency for them. Basically, he finds that this ivory is going from the point of where the elephants are killed, traveling north, and basically getting in the hands of terrorists and funding terrorists. So this is a much, much bigger problem than we would have ever anticipated.
Well, George, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
George Dante, he's founder of Wildlife Preservations and created the false ivory tusks used by journalist Brian Christie to track illegal ivory trading in Africa. That journey was covered in the September issue of National Geographic magazine and Warlords of Ivory. That's an episode of National Geographic's Explorer. You can find more, including a link to read his article. There's also a terrific interview from Fresh Air with Brian Christie. We'll put the link to that as well. All of that at wordofmouthradio.org. And now we turn to an entirely different kind of man-made appendage for an entirely different use. In 2007, Eric Jones had his right hand amputated due to a disorder that cut off blood flow to his hands and his feet. He was among the first 10 people in the U.S. to be fitted with a bionic prosthetic. Eric and his daughter Lainey and son Alex went to StoryCorps to talk about his life-altering operation.
How did you get your bionic hand, Dad?
On the internet.
Did you just go to Google and look up bionic hand?
I don't remember exactly, but I was looking for a prosthetic, and I found this bionic hand. It's a glove that fits on the stump, and there's a sensor that picks up a muscle signal in the palm of my hand, and I flex the muscle, and the fingers move, and they close all at once. And then I flex it again, and then the fingers open.
What do you miss most about not having a hand?
I miss playing the piano, because I could play the piano when you sing, Lainey. And I can't throw the baseball yet, but I'm trying to figure out how to do that so that we could play catch, Alex.
Yeah. Do you get tired of people asking about your missing hand?
Not really. People get curious. But it was pretty cool when I came to show and tell at second grade, though, right?
Yeah, that was cool.
What do you guys think about Dad's bionic hand?
Darth Vader. Darth Vader pops into my head, and so does Luke Skywalker, because they both had robotic hands.
What was it like when we came to visit you in the hospital for the first time?
Oh, it was awesome, because I hadn't seen you guys in a long, long time.
A month.
But I was a little nervous. You guys were going to be scared, and you were going to be sad. But when you guys came into the hospital room for that first time, you just kind of hung out with the old dad in the bed. And most kids, if their dad got this sick, would probably not handle it quite the way that you guys did, which I'm very, very proud of. Because I drop things all the time. I spill things all the time. I need help from you guys all the time. So one of the things I admire about both of you guys is that you're very patient and you help your dad.
Thank you, Dad.
Well, thank you. These were some great questions.
And that was Eric Jones with his children, Lainey and Alex, at StoryCorps in New York. Their interview will be archived along with all of the StoryCorps conversations at the Library of Congress.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this song has been stuck in our head for days. It's called Turn It Around from the band Lucius, a five-piece indie pop band from Brooklyn playing tomorrow night at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Lucius flips the script on the traditional pop configuration of men prancing around in front of the stage and girl singers in the back. Instead, a pair of identically dressed women front the band, and the three guys mostly stay out of the limelight. One of them is guitarist Pete Lalish, who was born and raised in New Hampshire. And the band also has New England roots in a way. They all studied at the Berklee School of Music in Boston, where, Peter remembers, those two women were already inseparable.
We didn't really know each other directly at school. I think I passed by the girls, which definitely they walked together even at school. They were a pretty tight duo there. So, you know, I knew them as singers. And Danny and I from the band, we were in a band together for many years. And so we moved to New York, and the girls moved to New York, and then we sort of regrouped there. So the band was officially formed in Brooklyn, but we all knew each other from school in Boston. And they actually had their own, when they were in Boston, they had their own sort of version of Lucius, which was, I'd say, maybe slightly more pretty straightforward folk influence. So then when, you know, we all met in New York and started playing together officially, then it really got all kind of mixed up with everyone's influences and sort of life problems at that point, what we sort of brought to the band in years after college.
Well, the two girls, Jess and Holly, they often perform in these kind of blonde page boy wigs. Now, I've seen the band a couple of times. They're totally charming, I guess is the only way I can describe them. But instead of, you know, being the two singing girls in the back, they're in the front. And you lads are at least visually least obvious. So what is that like?
Well, I'll have to correct you on one thing, which I've actually told people that I've met. I said, yeah, go give their wigs a yank, because they're actually their real hair.
No, for real?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, they look so perfect. I thought they were wigs.
I think the secret is, I mean, the secret's out. I think they get their hair done by the same person simultaneously, so that, you know, perfectly uniform.
But you guys are kind of like the background guys in some way.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, if you think about in the, you know, history of music, there's the idea of, there's a rhythm section, I know, a front man or front woman in a band. There's this idea that, oh, well, there's maybe a background horn section or background singers. And I think what Jess and Holly, you know, if I'm speaking for them and what I've experienced, I think a lot of the music they grew up listening to, like, you know, early soul music, 70s, you know, later soul music in the 70s, and bands that had, you know, backup singers, I think they were drawn to that because there's all this rich power, there's all this rich harmony. And then when you kind of take that towards the front, then what are you left with? You're left with like two super powerful vocalists kind of like, you know, acting as one sort of bullhorn. And I think that was sort of how they got into singing together. And then with the band, being in the back is perfect for me because, you know, I wouldn't want the spotlight. That's sort of something I feel comfortable being in the back, being supporting, and kind of like being able to kind of sneak in all the little noises that I like to do. She's a wilder woman. Oh,
that lush, big, you know, like Phil Spector-y wall of sound. Where did that come from?
Oh, I mean, you said it the best. I mean, the sound of the band definitely has been influenced by, you know, Phil Spector, you know, the span of his music from, you know, sort of the Ronnie Spector and the girl groups, and then also, you know, to the stuff he did with George Harrison. I'd even say the stuff he did with the Ramones, but, you know, that wall of sound is very fun when you're recording and when you're playing because, you know, it's a wash. It's this very satisfying wash of things, especially when you have Jess and Holly singing, and also Andy, who plays drum and guitar. He's a great singer, and a lot of people don't realize that his voice is actually in a similar range as theirs. So when you kind of record under those conditions, it creates this big kind of cavernous wave of reverb and vocal.
I'm listening to this music and thinking that there is a kind of slickness to it and urbanity, and you come from this lakey, you know, rugged, woodsy place. Do you feel like that's in your music anywhere?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that the band comes from all over the country, and I always thought, you know, oh, I'm the guy from the small town in the backwoods, but actually we all grew up with this sense of listening to songwriters and a sense of songwriting. And I think a lot of that common ground with us is that we love Bob Dylan, we love Joni Mitchell, you know, we love Harry Nilsson. All these things are rooted in folk music, and then a lot of that stuff is rooted in traditional music. So there's an element of us that goes into the studio stuff of like the 60s and 70s, and also the sort of straight folk music that we all grew up listening to.
So you're playing in Portsmouth. Is this kind of like a homecoming for you? I mean, are you showing the rest of the band what your place is like?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I feel so lucky to have grown up near the seacoast in New Hampshire. And I grew up going to the music hall, you know, seeing great movies. And I saw Taj Mahal there when I was a kid. And I saw B.B. King. And so it's going to be a very surreal moment to sort of look out and sort of see from the other side, and I'm really excited to, you know, to meet the people that run it, and it's just such a great venue, and I love sharing New England with people. I think that it, you know, feel very fortunate to have grown up in a place like this.
New Hampshire's own Peter Lalish, guitarist and vocalist for Lucius. Lucius is Jess Wolfe, Holly Lasig, Dan Malad, and Andrew Burry. And they're playing tomorrow at an Intimately Yours concert at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. There's ticket information or to see more music from Lucius, including an NPR Tiny Desk concert and a field recording with Wilco's Jeff Tweedy and his son inside of a tunnel. Go to wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you'll find the Word of Mouth podcast, so you never miss a minute. You can also find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please write a review or tell a friend. Pass it along. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.